Hello and welcome to this episode of the Ad Love Podcast. Do I have a treat for you today? My guest today is Abdul Hadi Shaidil. Some of you might know him, some of you might not. Abdul Hadi is a good friend of mine who I've known for many years, and I would say he is one of those people that are Islamically and traditionally trained. However, have a very good understanding of the way of life that we have in Western societies and cultures. And I feel like he's someone who's able to bridge the gap between those two ways of life, if I may put it that way. Because of the good relationship I have with Abdul Hadi, we get to talk about the nitty-gritty issues that the general community are having with our leaders. We talk about organizations and sometimes how those organizations have political agendas and what that means for us as people in the general population, trying our best to lead our lives in a righteous way while taking, you know, guidance from these community leaders and imams. Some of this conversation blew my mind right out of my skull, especially when Abdul Hadi talks about how our communities are all fighting righteous causes. But what can happen when we're not all on the same page fighting for the same thing? I really think this is an episode that I would love to have everyone listen to because I think it's super relevant to every single person who lives within our society, as we're all influenced one way or another by how our leaders are conducting their congregations. I hope I did a well enough job representing the viewpoints of our community. I feel like I did. If there is something that you feel like I did miss out on, please let me know. A follow-up conversation is not off the table. I hope you enjoy the episode as much as I did. Please help me in making my guest feel welcome, Abdul Hadi Shaidil.
Just add love. Don't be delirious. Just add love. Stop whining so serious. Just add love. A little more lenience. Just add love. The key ingredient.
All right, we're live. So we were talking about, the way we learn and how we're learning through the lens of our own preconceived ideas, which is on the podcast we've spoken about several times as the way I describe it, the easiest is the lens. Mm. Like all of our experiences and what we grew up with is a lens that with which we see the world. Mm. So if I say the word tree, for example, that evokes a different image in my mind than it does to you.
Yep.
You know, I think of a big tree, 100 years old. You might think of, you know, a smaller tree because you do a lot of gardening. So you might have a different idea, a different concept of what tree is. So we might read the same book and it might mean something vastly different. And that was that's what we're talking about, the difference between reading and like something like a workshop where your ideas are challenged or your answers are challenged.
Yep, definitely.
From your perspective, what do you think is important to remember when you're learning? Because you have a background in, I guess, traditional Islamic knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that's very new. It's something that you've done for a while. So what are some of the lessons like you that you might have learned on your journey?
Yep. So this is definitely a really deep question. But to kind of take off from where we're at, as in we were saying, the difference between learning from a book and learning from a person, right? You were saying that learning from a book, or we were kind of speaking about it, about how learning from a book, you're reading that book from your initial already preconceived lens, or a lens that you've learned probably from something else. So oftentimes, ideas that you do read about that coincide with your view, you take that on. Mm. And then views that don't quite coincide, you just kind of, okay, just forget about that. That kind of goes to the side. Unless you read with that intention to challenge yourself. Mm. So it's possible for those who have the tools to do that. But oftentimes initial learners, they don't quite do that. But it goes back to once again, okay, what is the purpose of learning to begin with? Right? What's the purpose of learning? And the purpose of learning goes back, to a very deep question of, the purpose of the human. Mm. Right? The purpose of the human. Because if you think about And we know is, you know, if you usually in traditional circles, if you do think, you know, we probably have a word in mind when you think about the purpose of the human. You know, it goes back to the verse in the Quran about worship, right? But I want to take that. You know, we want to understand that that's important, but we also want to understand that the Islamic we can say the Islamic discussion on that concept is much wider than that. So there's actually a great book on ethics by the great Imam Al-Raghib Al-Asfahani. He writes this text. It's called Al-Dhari'a ila makarim al-Sharia, as in the path to you know, the noble aspects of the Sharia. And he mentions three aspects of human existence. Not three aspects, but three purposes of human existence. One of them is ibadah, which we acknowledge from the verse in the Quran.
Yep.
But the other two are essentially khilafah, which we know as vicegerency. But what is khilafah? Khilafah is actually being like Allah. But it's like, whoa, how do you be like Allah? But it's actually learning about the attributes of Allah, you know, such as Ar-Rahim, Ar-Rahman, Al-Malik, for example. All of these different names, and representing that in the human to the best that they can. So essentially it's about, you know, character refinement.
Right.
Character refinement.
Okay.
So basically the purpose of learning, right, coming back to that point, is tahdhib al-akhlaq, is improving the self, is character refinement, right? So how can there be character refinement without challenging the self? Learning from a book just reconfirms your initial preconception.
Yeah. So it's like a confirmation bias, because you're looking in the information or the knowledge that you're learning for what you already believe.
Exactly. But you don't
want there's that. No one there to kind of go, oh, these things that you're pushing to the side, like, what do you think about them, for example?
Yeah, exactly. So you need that teacher there, which is why you know, this is not just in Islam. You know, throughout history, you have the relationship between the teacher and the learner. And it's that tarbiyah, that essential nurturing for them to grow, you know, towards fulfilling that purpose of that human, you know, which we can just restrict to that, you know, being that person of noble character.
I think being very connected to many people in the community, a massive reason why people shy away from learning, from my experience in talking with people, is that a lot of the relationships that they have with people who are quote unquote learned haven't been positive ones. And for whatever reason, that refinement of character doesn't necessarily happen with the people specific. I'm picking my words very carefully.
This is
specifically with the people that have studied Islam. And, you know, to an extent, my response is, if you're studying whatever it is doesn't make you a better person, then there's something wrong with the way that you're learning.
Yeah, that's true. 100%.
Yeah.
Let me bring in a point here. It's a complicated issue, so it's hard to point. You know, we don't want to point fingers.
Right.
I know it's we don't even want to put it in terms of fault either, because the institutions upon which we can say traditional Islam had been taught, you know, normative Islam, they've been destroyed. You know, we know about colonization, you know, the various things that's happened in our Muslim lands. So many of these institutions have been destroyed. But as we know, you know, as in these they exist still in individuals. As in ilm, as in true knowledge, continues. So firstly, it's acknowledging that greater picture. But as in, you're right. As in, if you're studying traditional knowledge, studying Islam, and it's not coming out in that good character, then, you know, that's really problematic, right? Because someone who's studying Islam, you know, should be a representative of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But then instead, you're pushing your people away from the deen. That's the total opposite, right? But here, I guess one point that comes to mind as well, and this is a particular import from Ilm al-Akhlaq as well, is that there's actually a differentiation between the Sharia and the intellect, right? Mm. I don't want to create a dichotomy between the two, because you can only understand the Sharia through the intellect. Mm. But at the same time, the intellect is protected from through the Sharia. Yeah. But the intellect, right, is what the person who is learned in the deen, he should be able to then identify in his own culture what is right and wrong in the terms of that culture.
Mm.
Right? So, and this is really important because when you're dealing with people who want to study the deen, but they exist in a culture, which I'm speaking about, the current age that we live in, there's a lot of tension with religion.
Mm.
Religion is seen as something irrational. And and as Muslims, we definitely inherit some of that, right?
Yeah.
So this, I guess, this person who has learned the deen, right, who embodies this prophetic character, should then be able to use their intellect and understand the urf, understand the custom, and then present, a solution. One example here is, this is a lot of it is to do, one example is, for example, Dr. Omar Farooq Abdullah. Mm. He has his concept of the cultural imperative. And one of the forms that he really supports, for example, Yusuf Islam. Mm. He basically, recently Yusuf Islam had a tour, I think it was a year or 2 years ago, around the world. And Dr. Omar actually went to every concert. Yeah. According to what I've heard.
Yeah.
And, that was an amazing way to introduce people to Islam. Music broke down the antagonism.
Yeah.
And he sang songs, about his conversion, about finding love.
Yeah.
But, they weren't explicit in the songs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he spoke about his conversion to Islam in the concert.
Mm.
What an amazing way, right? To introduce non-Muslims, to Islam, but in a completely different light. And this is amazing, but then at the same time we have others learning the deen who would say outright completely music is
wrong,
for example. It's kind of like but it's complicated. I'm not saying
it's a massive topic, I know, but when I do it in a way where if someone makes like a grand statement, are you sure? Right? So then when I ask them that question, automatically they're like, oh, why is he asking that question? Right? Because I think from speaking to so many people who have been affected negatively and positively through people who have studied Islam. And again, we don't want to point fingers, but if this is what we're talking about, like learning and transformation of character through learning. I feel like sometimes it gives authority to people to be so absolute in their statements. Mm.
Mm.
And my job is to poke holes into it.
Definitely.
It's such a subtle, shifty way of doing it. But then just even that, like, oh, this is haram. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you sure? Where'd you hear that from? Just like those two questions, people are like, oh, crap. And then, sometimes you'll get a third one. Like, you read that on Facebook or... You know what I mean? And then it makes people evaluate, okay, oh, crap, where did I hear this from? Did I see this on a post?
Yep,
have I verified that information?
Because
we know how many people, even recently, you'll get viral messages on Instagram or Facebook or WhatsApp. And then 3 hours later, there's like a retraction that goes around that makes the rounds.
That was you, was that?
So then it's very well known that in this age of information, which is what it's being called now, the age of the flow of information, we have to be very careful about what we're saying.
I've had
very, let's call them impassioned conversations with people. And I've told them very straight out, your view of this topic is actually causing these very tangible problems in our society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know it's very heavy to put on one person to go, because of you, this is, but you are now perpetuating this stereotype.
Yeah.
Or you're perpetuating this misinformation, or, you know, and.
Let me take it. There's a bit of a step back to what you said earlier about when someone makes such a broad claim, right? And the way you approached it, you said, are you sure? Why is that the case? Yeah. This what this reminds me of is the you know, because there's a whole literature out there in our own tradition. There's one called the etiquettes of debate, essentially. But when we think about the etiquettes of debate, unfortunately, adab has people have understood it in a very strange way, and as a result, they you know, their own selves kind of reject it. But that's because I really believe that people don't actually have that correct conception of what adab is. So I'm not going to use that word. I'm just going to say that there are literatures out there that explain you the correct ways of debate. And oftentimes, you know, when someone, you know, let's think of an example. When on Facebook, right, someone makes a claim, right? They say, let's just say something is haram, for example. What would be like, if someone who disagrees, what would they do? They would actually mention a counterclaim, and then they would argue for their counterclaim. Isn't that right?
Right.
That's what they would do, right?
Yep.
But
yep.
The adab or the correct way of debate, in according to our predecessors, it would be to ask why. Well, where'd you get that from?
Yeah, I love it.
Right. So this is because I think, you know, the way you explained it perfectly, I think it actually gets the person to actually think about, okay, where did I actually get this from? Or why do I actually think this? Right? Because they're different things. Because some knowledge, you know, some knowledge you can only know through transmission. Because you don't have, I guess, an intellect, or we don't have the intellectual ability to come to that conclusion. Such as, you know, things of revelation, you know, things that happen in the Day of Judgment, for example. You know, where'd you get that? You'd ask the question, where'd you get that from? Right? Then they have to confirm their sources. But some sorts of knowledge, you know, claims which are based on deduction, I can't think of something right now, but basically, yeah, as in, you're asking for evidence for that claim. So someone thinks of so you know, it really highlights, I guess, you know, the wisdoms of just being able to kind of, what's that etiquette of that first reaction, and then it just opens so many doors to good, right?
Yeah, I think as well, seeing that we're on the topic, I think something I've been saying a lot lately is social media is such a crappy way to communicate with people.
And I've heard anti-social media.
Yeah. Look, I see. I think the best way to communicate with someone is exactly what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
You're sitting in front of me. I can see your mannerisms. I can hear the inflections in your voice. I can see when you're looking directly at me or you're looking away, kind of thinking. You know, the differences in the tone of voice, all of it adds, you know, we already know through studies and science that, you know, more than 80% of our communication is nonverbal.
Yep.
And then after that is probably like a video call. And then after that is maybe a phone call. Yep. And then after that is a text or email. And then right at the bottom is social media. Because it's like on show, like everyone can see.
Yeah.
And I just find that so interesting that people will take to social media, but they won't sit and have a conversation. Like, I've had so many people tell me, oh man, you should get in contact with this person, you know, from overseas, and maybe do a podcast with them. And I'm like, I love that idea. And there are many people overseas that I would love to have on. I just can't do it. I really want to have conversations with people. I really want to sit and have, you know, a discussion, whether I agree with you or I don't agree with you, or we're on the same page or not.
Yeah.
I just, for me, this is a learning experience, and I want to do it face to face. There's so much more.
Definitely, yeah.
And then if you're going to talk about debate or discussion, especially on a, you know, a topic that is reliant on our faith or our creed, like, this is not something you do on a social media site.
Yeah, definitely.
Where on the same site, people are taking photos of their dinner. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to have this discussion, like, some people will ask me very simple questions. Doesn't matter about their background or what their faith is or whatever the case is. Someone will ask me a very in-depth question. And I told them, if you're really wanting to know an answer, let's go have a coffee and I'll explain the answer to you. 98% of people don't contact me after that. Yeah. Or they do, but about something else. They don't actually take me up on that offer. But it's the ones that contact me, they want to know. So then it's like, what's the purpose of you, quote unquote, seeking an answer? Is it so that you have ammo? Are you looking for a screenshot so you can send it to your WhatsApp buddies and have a laugh? You know what I mean? Like, what's the purpose of your conversation or debate? Even before you get to the adab and akhlaq of your debate, what's the purpose? What are you are you actually trying to learn? You know, like that saying, it's like some people listen to understand and then some people listen because they're waiting for their turn to respond. So for me, the question is like even deeper than that. Like, why are you even asking that question? Do you really want to know? Because to know, it takes effort, it takes time, it takes a desire to understand. Because without the desire to understand, like if you run away from something or you're not actually listening, you're not going to understand fully. Because understanding is holistic. Not understanding what you think you need to understand. Do I understand it on its own? On its own merit? Do I understand this thing, this in front of me? It's a pen. Like, do I understand where it came from? Do I understand its purpose? Like, not just what I see from the pen, but understanding it holistically. That's true knowledge for me, in my understanding of that word. So
I guess if we think about the pen, you could understand it from the perspective of, I guess, its purpose.
Right.
But at the same time, you could understand it from the perspective of what it can do for you. So in changing that, like, for example, changing that now, flipping the topic of the pen, now making it into a human, right? So is that, so are you now dealing with that human just purely because he or she can benefit you in some way or another? Or are you actually interacting with that human because you see a great objective? Like, there's a greater, you know, there's a great purpose to our lives. And every interaction that we have with everyone around us, you know, to bring all of us as humanity closer to that purpose. Yeah, but unfortunately, I feel, you know, I know this is a big shift, you know, from a pen.
No, it's fine.
Like, humanity is going in all sorts of different directions, you know, all sorts of different people. They have different goals. It's kind of that, and you see that in the debates that happen, you know, on which are exemplified. Or we can say the voices are really loud on social media. You know, some people are calling for, let's say, for justice, which is a very important thing. Some people are calling for liberty. Some people are calling for equality. Like, all of these various, you know, really important things. But then, if there's no way for us to kind of come in agreement to what's most important, then all it becomes is a world in which people are clashing in wills. Unfortunately, all it ends up happening is that we're just trying to push our wills on another person such that they fulfill what we want them to do, as opposed to there being an ultimate reality where we're all traveling to. And at the end of everyone's lives, we can have this evaluative judgment. Okay, this person, you know, because of this ultimate reality that we believe in. And for Muslims, we believe, you know, there is Allah, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was his messenger. We are on, all of us are on this ultimate journey, you know, towards the next life. And then we help each other. We hold each other account. When we tell someone, for example, you have to pray, right? We're not judging them. We're not pushing our wills on them. We're not trying to force them. We're just saying, okay, there's, you know, you believe in this. You know, there's this reality that you believe in because you're Muslim. And I'm just reminding you of that reality. Because in the end, you know, when we come to the next life, that's what's important.
Yeah. I find it interesting when you touched on a very important topic about forcing our view or our ideas onto someone else. And it's interesting to see that happen when those views or ideas are liberty. You're forcing the idea of freedom of action onto someone. You're literally doing the opposite of the thing you're calling for. And I think people get caught up in causes and they want so desperately to belong because we're in such a fractured state. that they don't feel like that they do belong. So that when they see something that they agree with, excellent, they feel like they're a part of that thing. But then the extent that they go, you know, they might feel enlightened, which is excellent. Like, I love that for people. I love for people to, you know, have a strong belief and have a goal and a drive and a direction. Like, that's all I want for everyone. I want people to not only have those positive goals, yep, but achieve them as well. And that's what I try and do through everything that I do, is to try and get people to see their goals, get people to see what they want to achieve, mm-hmm, figure it out, yep, and then, yep, get there.
Yep.
Because that's like that fulfillment is beautiful, mm-hmm, you know, and it's fulfilling in itself, and it contributes to the overall happiness in their life and those kinds of things. But then, mm-hmm, I feel like some people get so caught up in the cause that you literally end up doing the opposite of what you're trying to, mm-hmm, you're forcing, mm-hmm, liberty, which is like it's an oxymoron. You're like liberty, you're trying to tell people everyone should be free to do what they want,
but you're forcing that onto you know, that I feel that happens because this is another great thinker. He's really old now, in his 90s. His name is Alasdair MacIntyre, who's he's a Catholic, but he speaks about this forcing your views on other people. But his diagnosis of the issue is that it's because we live in a society where we're actually not taught how to sort through these different values. We're taught, like, for example, you know, we're taught that equality is important, you know, liberty is important, arguments for schooling, right? So, you know, an argument from equality is that education, you know, education can't be bought. You know, it should be freely available to everyone. And then, and no person should have the ability to purchase a share of education to the disadvantage of somebody else. So that's an argument from equality. But an argument from liberty is more of, okay, well, a teacher, you know, has the right to enter into contracts as they wish, right? If they wish to teach particular people, and they wish to teach, you know, another group of people, they should have that freedom, that liberty to do so. Even students, if students wish to study with particular people, so they should have the freedom to enter into contracts as they so will. So, you know, they're both, you know, kind of, you know, attractive arguments. Mm. Some people will focus
in
on
this
that
way, and
in the other way. Okay, that's great, but then. But how do you actually then, like, we're not actually taught. Because when it goes down to liberty versus equality, what's more important?
Mm.
Like, as in it's, and then it reaches that it's this interminability of, like, then people start butting heads, they start yelling, and then the arguments just don't end.
Yeah.
Which is what we see.
Yeah, which is what we have generally.
You know, we just have to find that common ground. Because
people don't want to find common ground. I know I'm generalizing. I just feel like some people. So we're just talking about the reasoning behind interacting with another human being, right? Like, why are you asking questions? Why are you trying to figure out information? So many people want to box you into something. They need to label you. Okay, Abdul Hadi, I've just met you. I don't know too much about you. I'm going to ask some questions because I'm just trying to, like, sort through my radar to see where you fit on my spectrum.
And then as a result...
And then that's how I can... All right, you're a 6 out of 10 here, right? Now I know how to deal with you according to my tribe.
All
right. Right? According to the people that I belong to, or the ideology that I belong to, or where I... You know what And... Look, growing up, I went to, like, a Muslim school for quite a few years, and then I finished off my high schooling in a public school. And now that I reflect back on it, that happened so much. Like, I used to, like, I was obviously in a Muslim school. Everyone generally is Muslim. So you deal with them in that way, But then when I went to a public school, I have a funny story, man. I was like literally my first week in this public school, and we had gone to Friday prayer, and I came back to class and I sat next to this guy, and I'm like I was just kind of getting to know him. Mm-hmm. And I was like asking him, like, you didn't join us, or, you know, not in a judgmental way, but in a curious way, you know, what's the go? And then we entered into this really like stupid conversation for 15 minutes of him making excuses, and then I was like very curious, and I've never heard this stuff before, these excuses or whatever. And then after like 15 minutes, he's like, dude, I'm not even Muslim. But it never occurred to me in my whole, like my whole concept was just shattered, like,
Oh, I see.
Right? And this, it's such a small, funny story, but there's so much to learn from that.
Mm-mm.
You know, obviously I was young and I didn't know, but.
So you're saying, so the other guy who you thought was Muslim wasn't even Muslim?
No, he wasn't.
But okay.
But he was just joking around. Like, he was just like messing with me. Because I was new to the school, and he's like, relax, bro, I'm not even Muslim.
Right. Okay,
and I'm like, because I was like tripping out. I'm like, what are these even excuses? What are you even saying? But I don't think he understood either. He was just going with it and just mucking around. But in my head, I was like really trying to wrap my mind around this justification that didn't even exist. I'm like, what's going on? Like, my mind was like, my little mind was exploding. And then after he was getting annoyed, he's just like, bro, relax, man. I'm not even Muslim. But like, if you reflect on it, you reflect on this, like, there's lessons to learn from that, you know, of accepting people and like preconceived notions and all of this. Like, I'm not going to break down the situation. I just felt like it was a funny story to add in here. But we really, again, I keep going back to that because I feel like there's so much truth into the fact that we really want to belong. Like, we lack that belonging. And unfortunately, the states that we'll go to, or the lengths that we'll go to in order to access that belonging, is not necessarily the best place all the time.
It's like I'm trying to put myself in someone's shoes, as in, you know, which in fact I think all of us are, like, to some extent like that, as in we're seeking this, you know, we're seeking this, we can say, what's the word, it's not coming to me at the moment, but that validation, you know, that validation from others. And it's, you know, as in if we're not getting it, you know, as in if you didn't get it growing up, you know, from, because generally, you know, if you're coming from a healthy family, in which, you know, you had, you know, parents who would, you know, who taught you, parents who taught you that the world was a safe place, you know, as in they held you when you were crying, you know, and, you know, like, you know, they introduced you, that job of that parents to introduce you to the world as a safe place.
In a healthy way,
In a healthy way. Allahu alam, as in, you would say that, you know, this kind of craving the attention of others, and, you know,
seeking that because it's something that you got you in a healthy have. Way, yeah, right,
you're,
right.
You're that, you know, that healthy heart, you know, that upbringing that gave you that healthy heart. But I guess, you know, if you're someone who didn't receive that, then you'll seek that from other sources. And essentially, you know, what is it? The point I'm trying to bring up is that, you know, whatever you latch onto, rather than being an appreciation of what is true, just becomes this thing to fill that hole. Like, what I mean is that because you know, it goes back to the I'm putting it in terms of seeking knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say someone who is seeking, you know, seeking knowledge, the ultimate intention of seeking knowledge is guidance to what is true. Let's say they're not looking for what is true, but they're looking to fulfill that void in their self. Whatever they receive, whether even it could be the truth. That whatever they receive from that other person, it could be the truth, but rather it just becomes this, you know, this vehicle to fulfill that void. I'm trying to get to something, but it's just not coming out.
That's all right.
Yeah, is it?
I think through conversation as well, like we explored that idea. I also come into contact with people who, through that desire to do the right thing and belong and learn the right things, are so desperate to receive that that they put themselves in vulnerable positions from others who have what they're searching for. Okay, I'll give you another example that's not related to knowledge, just a hypothetical, then kind of bring it back. If I'm in the desert desperate for water, right, and I'm like, you know, hallucinating and I'm like on my last legs, like whoever has water has power over me. Because they have something I desperately need for survival. Now, bringing it back to the real world, there are some people that are so desperate to do the right thing or to make amends for a life that they may perceive as sinful, or get to such, they want to attain a station with Allah. Whatever the case is, they are become that person in the desert that's seeking the water. And the person that's holding the water has power over them. You know, and we hear several stories, like, and it's happening. I don't think it's happened. I don't know. Look, I don't know statistically what we're talking about here, but I feel like the stories are now coming to light more often of people that are in desperate need of that water, and the people with water taking advantage of those people. And that's another reason, going back to what we were talking about before, is a it's another contributing factor to why people have such a sour taste in their mouth. And it's like this double-edged sword where I say, on one end, we rely so much on the people providing this knowledge to do so much for us that we're overloading them with all of these other tasks that they may not be trained in, or these other disciplines that they may not be trained in. But then on the other side of the sword, you have a position of power, and we have to understand what that looks like. And we, although like we can say, yeah, they're only human beings and they're flawed, and but also you have, in such a time where people are so desperate and people are just looking for truth. You have such a massive responsibility, and I don't envy that. And that's why we're told, you know, be careful.
Definitely, be careful,
because we know, like, you know, some of the first people that are judged are the ones that we look up to, and we're so it's be careful what you're wishing for. I don't envy that job, but I still think to a certain extent account needs to be held. And then also the issues that we go to those people that are on, like, you don't go to the mechanic to fix your tooth.
I think you've touched on that, the issue of overloading. I guess we'd call them the mashayikh, kind of overloading the mashayikh.
Or leaders, just leaders in general.
It goes back to our initial point, as in how the institutions that we need, which I guess we would have had in our, in what we call the Islamic countries, right? They, you know, they were pretty much destroyed. But at the same time, coming here, right? Coming here in, coming here to the West, the migrant communities, when they came here, and establishing the Muslim community here, there were particular, I guess, you know, obligations and social needs that needed to be established. Because, you know, as in, like, for example, leadership, right? Leadership in the Muslim community. How does that happen? You know, it's quite interesting. Is actually, if you read this in the books of fiqh, it actually says, okay, well, is it possible to actually go to the non-Muslim leader for them to appoint an imam for you? It's really strange, right? But why is that? Because there's actually, you know, a, you could say a strong relationship between, we could say, you know, authority and order, like authority and order,
right?
Like, okay, what the point that I'm trying to bring up here is that in the absence of authority and order comes through, I guess we can make that claim right now, through authority, you get a mess, right? What do I mean by that?
Say that again. In the absence of
In the absence, you know, in the absence of authority,
yep,
right? like because one of the responsibilities of authority is to punish those who go out of line, right? So if for example, like a Muslim community, a new fledgling Muslim community, right, is in need of an imam, right, to kind of, let's say, to organize the needs of the Muslim community, right? People could, for example, come together and select one imam. But what prevents another group to select another imam, or another group to select another imam? Which is actually what's happened here in Sydney, in Australia.
Yeah.
If all of these different authorities, you know, if, for example, something else had been done, but once again, you know, we recognize the failings of non-Muslim authority.
Yeah.
Once again, you know, these things need to be weighed in the current context.
Yep.
Because, you know, these were.
Well, what happened? Yep. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. These are kind of opinions in classical Islamic texts. So we always have to kind of reassess their viability
in current times.
But it does kind of bring up a question. Okay, you know, in the absence of that strong authority, which can hold to account, you know, imams that aren't doing what they're meant to be doing, or put in. Give credibility to imams that have been, given that sort of tick that, you know, they're properly qualified. You know, that this is a really big question. How many shuyukh are actually shuyukh? You know, how many people that claim to be scholars? That's a huge word, right? You know, who claim to be ulama are actually. You know, maybe all they did was that they disappeared for 2 years and they came back, disappeared for 3 years and they came back. All you know is that, you know, as in, once again, it goes back, you know, to kind of like, you know, the authorities, as you know, the kind of the what's it called, the authorities in the Muslim countries, they themselves, you know, there's, you know, lots of stuff, broken corruption and all that sort of stuff.
Well, that's why I was stuttering before, because I wanted to ask. I just wanted you to finish your point, though. What happens when the Muslim authority is responsible for appointing an imam or a leader of the people, and then obviously because of their politics or like whatever their agenda is, they're going to select someone that's going to continue on their agenda?
Yeah.
So then in that case, it's also...
Yeah, so you have a maxim in fiqh, which is like the qadi, you know, kind of like the ruler, always has to act in the public interest of the Muslims, right? So if they're not acting in the public interest of the Muslims, they're just perpetuating their own political interest. Then there's actually room to say, okay, what you're doing is invalid. It's not valid according to the Sharia. And the thing about public interest, yani maslaha, you know, as in people of knowledge, right? You don't need authority to determine what is good for the public. You could get, let's say, you know, you could get maybe a bunch of, you know, a group of other ulama who are, you know, who have been recognized, you know, as people who are, you know, as in they've had a proven track record. Because unfortunately, you know, there are some groups in authority. I'm, you know, as picking my words carefully as well. Who don't have a good track record. We need to. I don't want to say to build, to get an. We don't want to get another new council,
right?
But rather, what we want to do now is to, because we don't need new leaders. What we need now are people who can hold leaders to account, right? So, which is why for example, it's so important for example, people to study the book of Ilm of Imam al-Ghazali, for example. Why do we study the book of Ilm? Is not only that we know how to be good seekers of knowledge, is so that we can actually now identify who are the ulama, who are the people who truly know, and then we can figure out solutions from there. Because once again, like solutions, like sometimes as well, Allahu Alam, you know, we might depend too much on the mashayikh to give us solutions,
right? Yeah. Well, but that was the original point was...
Yes. We're kind of depending too... Exactly. We're depending too much on them. But the thing is that the, you know, the, like, for example, the ulama, there are many types, right? I'm picking, for example, now there's the faqih, the one who is learned in Islamic law. His job is, you know, his job is not to come up with new solutions. His job is just to say, okay, people come with solutions, tweak this slightly, and then it'll be halal, you know?
Yeah.
Which happens in, a good example of this is in Islamic finance. Like the bankers, they have their brains making these contracts and all that sort of stuff. And then you have your Sharia boards that say, okay, just do this, just do this. Yeah.
And well, if you change point 3 and 4 in this contract, then then it falls within what's halal.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Which then points that we need a greater discourse, a greater connection between, you know, between the scholars and between the practitioners. But my final point here is that the language, like you might know this as well, the language in which the ulama speak in, I'm not talking about Arabic English, the language of their profession or their proficiency is very different than the language of modern jobs, occupations. Like what I'm specifically thinking of is having myself studied normative to extent, you know, just kind of scratched the surface in normative Islam. But when you have someone else who's learned, let's say, in a modern university, talking about the same topic, but it's very different languages. We really have to rack our brains and really think about those common points. It's actually not it's actually not easy.
Also, I think because you're studying sciences that have been around for hundreds of years, and then you're applying them to this year. Language changes over time. Actual language, Arabic, English, changes over time. And the norms that are spoken change over time. Just going back to what we said, like the word tree evokes different things for you and me, right? But then this is not necessarily about our lens that we're looking at it with. We're talking about like physical, like what is normally used within the language. You're studying a science that's been around for hundreds of years. And then the word justice or freedom might have different connotations depending on the time that you're studying them in.
Can I bring up an example? Yeah,
of course.
Like, for example, what comes to mind when you think about the word happiness? Happiness, you think about the opposite of?
Sadness.
Sadness, right. But do you think that's what Imam Ghazali meant when he wrote The Alchemy of Happiness? He didn't mean that. He didn't mean happiness, the alchemy of happiness as opposed to sadness. Because happiness, before it changed to mean this kind of emotional, psychological value, it actually meant someone who was happy was someone who was fulfilling their purpose. It was that. So you could be sad and happy, you could feel sad, but be happy at the same time.
Right.
So it's like,
I think people equate happiness with joy.
Yes, happiness with joy. But happiness, so that's the problem. So when someone advertises a course on let's go read the alchemy of happiness, it's not about joy.
Yeah.
It's about actually how are you going to fulfill your purpose, which then goes down to the hadith of character, you know, of becoming a person of good character. But even before character, having certainty in our core beliefs. Because, you know, as in, we know, and this is something that happens all the time when we hear about stories of people converting to Islam, is that after living, years of doubt, when they have that certainty about the ultimate reality of existence, then they just, you know, it just changes their lives, right? So the alchemy of happiness is about that.
That doesn't mean they didn't experience joy in their life before. It's like that overall idea of happiness is because of they've now achieved the purpose.
They have
that fulfillment of purpose.
Yep.
Is what happiness meant.
And within that happiness is joy as well.
Yeah.
Right? You know, by seeking happiness, you get joy. But by seeking joy, you might not get happiness.
Right.
In the sense.
So what does the bridging of that divide look like? Like on a very practical level, like here and now.
I think it,
yeah. It's a huge question.
No, I think I think it really comes down. It really comes down to, I don't know, as in, because this is what I've heard from some other people who are concerned about, you know, kind of this bridging these gaps.
Mm.
It's no longer about that individual who masters the sciences and then can, you know, because knowledge is so vast now, right? Now it's probably going to be about, you know, it's about groups of scholars, groups of professionals. But then that highlights just the importance of, you know, of character refinement, because everyone, you know, people who work in academia, you know, they know, you know, some academics have told me the arrogance that sometimes it breeds. And if you have arrogance, this doesn't only happen in academia, it happens
anywhere.
Even, you know, people studying the Islamic sciences.
Yeah.
You know, it comes down to, you know, in order for these true solutions to come about, you know, we need people to come together. And that involves, you know, getting over egos, you know, really thinking just beyond political interests, but more about essentially justice. But here, let me mention something about justice. In the books of Akhlaq, they speak about the sub virtues of the four cardinal virtues. You know, we have wisdom, courage, temperance, and justice. Mm. But can you guess what is the first? This was surprising when I found out the first sub virtue of justice. What do you think it is?
The first sub
virtue, as in, like, if someone who has justice, then out of that comes forth one. You know, many, many sub-virtues. And the first one that they chose to mention was true friendship.
From
justice. True friendship.
Wow. Because that's interesting.
Why is that?
Justice.
Why is that?
Because we don't equate, like, the everyday person wouldn't equate true friendship with justice.
Yes. Why is that? But let's work through it.
Like, yeah. Okay.
Because what is true friendship? True friendship is to love for your brother what you love for yourself, okay. Right? Yeah. And if you think about justice as distributive justice, as justice in the sense of, you know, returning the rights of those who are wronged, how does that happen? It happens, you know, when those who have, you know, when the rich in society give to the poor, and in order for the rich to give to the poor, it's not about just giving them spare change, right? It's about truly
giving,
embodying what you love for yourself, which might be wealth, and you want them for those who are less fortunate. That's kind of where that true justice comes about. Does that, I don't know, that's how I made sense of it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, that, I think that's a lot to take in, like that connection. Between true friendship and justice.
Maybe.
I think it could be as well, like, just thinking out loud here.
Yeah.
Within true friendship, there is a dance.
Yes.
Between two people. And sometimes in the relationship between two friends, person one might be a little bit needier than person two. And it's up to person two to compromise and help or contribute to that. And then there might be person two needs a little bit more than person one. So there's this back and forth in the connection of the friendship.
Yeah.
Just like in justice, there's back and forth between people or between leaders and followers or between anyone in a relationship.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a connection there.
Yeah, definitely. I think you can only be a true friend to someone if the other person is a true friend to you.
Yeah.
Otherwise. Yeah,
because it's not a friendship, it's a service.
Yeah.
You're serving. Yeah. One person is serving the other.
Yeah.
I think it was, I don't want to misattribute it. One of the Sahaba, but he said that true friendship, it's like if there's a string that's being held by two people. And when one person lets up, the other person pulls, so that string stays tight.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the other person pulls, the other person lets up. So there's this back and forth, and it's like a constant, like a dance between two people. I keep using that because I feel like there's a, a poetic.
I think this is another example where words can get lost in translation.
Right.
Because there's different words for friendship in the Arabic language. You know, there's the one I'm talking about now is sadaqa. But there's, for example, you know, as in the sadiq. This is the word which is used in the akhlaq literature. But there's levels of friendship, and I can't but help but think about Moby, who has her theory.
But, shout out to Moby.
But as in, I think like what you're talking about in the dance, right? That's not the true friendship. That's because the true friendship is, you know, this is like a really, really high level of friendship, which even the scholars of akhlaq, they only say you can only have probably one true friendship. You've ever have a true friend in your life.
Mm.
It's like a really high level, and most people never ever can
attain that.
So, you know, as in you have, but definitely any companionship, you know, as in, having people of companion, as in the word suhba, musahaba, things like that, you know, these are very important. But at the same time, I think that really high level of friendship might be something different that we're talking about. Allahu alam. But back to why did we bring up justice again?
You said the four attributes,
the four virtues. Yeah. The four virtues. But yeah, we mentioned about how we were talking about the people coming together.
Yeah.
Yeah, the solution to the to that
bridging the divide. Bridging,
so it comes down essentially to you know, character refinement. How do we get there?
That's another question. Like the character refinement, how do we
because
from my understanding, and you would have a deeper understanding, but from my limited understanding, is that when people sought out Islamic knowledge, there was always a beginning chapter, if you want to call it, of that, or the journey started with a refinement of character. Mm. Akhlaq was the first thing you started before you learn how to make your wudu properly. Before you learn how to wash yourself in the toilet. You have to learn how to learn.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you have to learn how to be a good student.
Yeah,
and then you have to learn how to treat other people before you even start.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're 6 months, 1 year in, and you're just learning how to be a good person first.
In fact, that was, because that was all, yeah, you're right. But the thing is that a lot of that was done when they were kids.
Right.
You know, like as in.
Yeah, yeah. You go live with the teacher, or you spend so much time with the teacher that you are learning their attributes. Yep, and
Exactly. So you bring up a really interesting point, because but in fact, like as in all three, like the three aspects of the deen are really important, right? You have your beliefs, then you have your outward actions, and then you have your heart, right? Which is where akhlaq is. Yeah. But the question is, okay, where, you know, which one is more important? Which one is less important? Well, they're all important from different perspectives, right? The great, you know, as in, yeah, let me bring up, this is actually in one of the books of Imam al-Haddad. It's like a wonderful book of letters. And he says that, okay, the people who are really interested it's called the people who are realized and the knowers of God, he lists an order of what's most important, right? The most important for them is building their certainty in God, the yaqeen. And then the second after that is good character with people. And then the third after that is then making sure that their acts of worship are valid. And then after that, making sure that they fulfill their obligations in terms of making a living. So it's interesting, is that order. So certainty, and then good character, and then acts of worship, and then, you know, making a living. And then he flips it around. He says, the people of the dunya, the other way around. They're all interested. All they're interested about is making a living, what's comfortable. And then maybe after that, yani, is my salah valid? And then very few of them will think about having good character with other people. Mm. And then I'm thinking about myself, you know. You know, where am I in that? You know, I'm still thinking about, is my, you know, how's my salah?
we're far from where we would like to be, I think.
But however,
I think a lot of people have that sentiment.
Yeah, but however though, like the Muslim community as a whole, like we like there's this kind of dilemma, right? Okay, we're really concerned about our salah. Like it comes out, like, I even feel it, like there's so much about tahara, salah, zakat, sawm, hajj, right? But where is the akhlaq? Comes back to the beginning, what you're talking about, right? People who are learned in the deen, but where's the akhlaq? If you know, if we open up one of Imam al-Ghazali's works, right, what he begins with, you know, bidayatul hidayah, it begins with these acts of worship, these small things that we do, whether it's dua, you know, kind of having this in, you know, or salah, you know, sawm and, you know, prayer and fasting. It does, like, no doubt it begins with that. But the problem, I think one of the major problems that exists in, you know, in Islamic education is that it begins there, which is right, but it ends there, which is wrong. Uh-huh. It has to
transcend that.
It has to transcend, because, you know, if you know, you have to transcend.
It's like putting the foundation down and then not building the house.
Exactly, right?
Just yeah.
Exactly.
Like the cement slab is there, and then what? And then that's done. What? Yeah. You can't live on that.
And then people think the cement slab, that is Islam.
That is Islam.
But no. Oh. But once you have the foundations,
oh, that's beautiful.
Then you have to build that.
Upon that.
Yeah, but unfortunately, you know, I think we don't, like, unfortunately, the somehow the message is not getting out there.
Mm.
The message is, you know, you just do that, and then somehow, Allahu Alam. I think the modern world is it really busies you. It's not like a society where you can, for example, just do a few things, and then, you know, there's a lot of things in place for you to make sure that your kids grow up in Islam.
Yeah,
like many things which you could leave to other people, you have to do yourself now.
Yeah.
So
and it's being replicated so many times because each person has to do it themselves.
Exactly, as opposed to, because we don't have,
like,
those institutions.
Like the saying that, oh, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. We don't have that village anymore. So everyone's having to do it themselves.
Exactly.
Right.
And so we're just kind of trapped in this cycle of we want to rise, but life is, you know, like life is just so busy. Mm. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, look, I think having conversations like these are super important, and I appreciate, like, you taking on some of the difficult questions, and because without these conversations, it's not going to start the thought process. Like, otherwise, if we don't talk about it, how is it going to get fixed, you know? Mm. And this is just the beginning. Like, all of these questions that we spoke about, all of the things we spoke about today, for me, it's just the beginning. Like, I think these conversations need to be had for the next 5 or 10 years, and people start slowly making changes, and institutions kind of making changes, and people making changes. And but if we don't talk about it, then we'll never understand it. And if we don't understand it, there's no change. Mm-hmm. We can't change something you don't understand, you know? Definitely. It's kind of the mantra I've been thinking about lately, is this concept of just trying to understand things without the need to fight it because it's different from me, or to change it because it's not the same as me. Just try and understand. Let's just understand. Let's just start there. Let's just learn. Mm. Let's learn from each other. Let you learn from me and me learn from you.
Yeah, that's very important.
And then once we have that conversation, once that dialogue is normalized, then we can start talking about solutions. Not to say that we can't look at solutions now, but without an understanding, the solutions are going to be flawed, because they might bring about new problems that we're not thinking about. I appreciate your time. We've done more than an hour.
Sorry,
it's the time.
I made sense.
No. It was good. It was good to see, like, from a perspective of, you know, someone who is rooted in the sciences, you know, like me. You know, my understanding always comes from community and people on the ground, very grassroots. Mm-hmm. That's where, you know, my passions lies, is with people. So when I talk to many people, I get a good sense of what the community is experiencing or going through. And it's important to have these conversations with, you know, and I hope one day to sit and have, like, more of these conversations with community leaders to understand their perspective. Yes, because there may be... And I'm 100% sure there are aspects that we're not taking into account.
Yeah,
you know? Yep. And again, without that conversation, we're not going to get anywhere.
Exactly.
We're not going to have that empathy that we need. like, oh, like, yeah, that must have been a tough decision. Mm-hmm. Instead of, why did that decision not go my way?
Yeah, you get what I mean? Yeah, exactly. It's easy, I guess, when you're not in that, you're not in that position. Yeah. It's easy to criticize.
But both. Know, but it's easy for person one to criticize person two, and it's easy for person two to criticize person one. Mm-hmm. It's like, do you have the strength to go above and beyond the criticism?
Yeah.
To go and understand holistically. That is the hard job.
That's really interesting, you know, as in, because before criticism, you need to understand, but somehow we've kind of jumped
straight. Skip the understanding and we're like, let's criticize. And what do we judge? If we skip the step of understanding, what are we criticizing upon? Are you the same as me?
Exactly.
And if you're not, you get criticized.
Yep.
So that's the whole drive behind Ad Love, is to have these conversations and to understand. The tagline is conversation and understanding, literally.
Which really points to that, I guess, that what we were talking about how people from different frameworks, they haven't been given the tools to kind of really understand each other.
Yeah.
But if they haven't given the tools, what's stopping them from coming together and figuring it out with each other?
But the main tool I see, the bridging of that gap, is dialogue, is the connection. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Exactly. Inshallah, we can have you back on soon, and then we can, you know, go next step and keep talking, and hopefully we keep having these conversations, and we keep, you know, I guess in our own disciplines, strive to understand each other.
Thank you for listening to that episode of the Ad Love podcast. I told you it was gonna be a doozy. I even just listening to that episode, it was amazing. It was mind-blowing. There were some concepts that I completely forgot I had even spoken about, and it was really, really good to hear it again. Please, please send this episode to anybody who you feel would benefit at all. That's what we want. As a community, we want to be able to help each other and spread these ideas and start these conversations. As always, look for every opportunity to add love to the world, and I hope to see you on the next episode of the Add Love podcast.